previously.tv podcast network.
A wrongful conviction is also a wrongful acquittal, and their family didn't get justice either, you know.
Joe Berlinger and his team look into whether prosecutors locked up the wrong guys, and a classic investigation discovery joint examines the perils of picking up the wrong guys, as Eve Beatty returns to discuss Starz's wrong man and IDs behind mansion walls in The Blotter Presents Episode 58. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, previously.tv's take on all things TV true crime. I am your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I am joined once again by Eve Beatty. Hello, Eve.
Sarah, have you really done 58 episodes of this show?
Yeah, apparently.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I would like to congratulate you. You must feel like you watched 58 episodes of TV and processed them. For those of you unaware, Eve Beatty is recapping Westworld for previously.tv, and between her going out of town, cramming two recaps into like 3 days, and prepping for this, a parade is on its way to her house. Just FYI, when you hear trombones,
Why. Okay, good. I was afraid that it was going to be, you know, something else. So that's a relief.
I'm not sure what else you were expecting. Thank you for doing your yeoman service for our little true crime podcast. Let's get right into it so that you can go take a nap with our Most Wanted section. So The Wrong Man is airing on Starz on Sunday nights. It premiered this past Sunday. Here's the case file adapted from Starz's media room description of the show. Joe Berlinger, best known for the Paradise Lost trilogy, and a team of esteemed experts, including a renowned civil rights attorney. It's not just any civil rights attorney. It's Ron Kuby, a former prosecutor, more on whom in a moment, a retired NCIS investigator and a member of Detroit's elite homicide task force, reinvestigate the cases of three inmates who have been locked up for decades and claim they're innocent. The show begins with the case of Evaristo Salas, convicted of a gang shooting at age 15, based on possibly flawed eyewitness testimony and an informant perhaps fed a story by the lead detective. This is a 6-episode series. Each case gets 2 episodes. Starz has asked reviewers to embargo plot points until airtime, but because it's hard for us to assess the show for you, the listener, without going into episode 2, we hope that Starz will forgive us because Starz is kind of hard enough to find as it is, and we would like to help them promote this show as well as talking about it ourselves. So, I liked it. Like, as a show, it's good. It's solidly built. Joe Berlinger is an expert at this. He knows what he's doing. It's fairly predictable product that actually put me in mind of, I can never remember the name of this damn show, but MTV had a version of this a few years ago.
Catfish. I think you're thinking of Catfish, Sarah.
I wish I were thinking of Catfish. Let us never think of Catfish again, even though now it could be covered by this little program because crimes. No, it featured a guy who had been wrongfully convicted and then released after 10 years in prison.
Oh, right,
in Missouri.
Right, yeah.
It was pretty good. It didn't get a second season, which was surprising given that Catfish is still dragging on. Sometimes dead is better. But I thought this was a good show, but perhaps not a great show for various reasons. Eve, overall, did you enjoy the process? Did you watch both screeners that we had?
I watched both screeners. How many did you watch, Sarah?
I watched 2.
Okay. Because, I mean, I think there are a lot of good things about how this show is structured, I think. I think that how they do the expositional stuff is pretty elegant. You know, how they introduce everyone, that they don't make it feel too cheesy or anything. Like, you first meet sort of our team of, you know, innocents. Or not innocents. I mean, I think that they sort of make it clear that they're just trying to figure this stuff out. You know, you meet the team in a good way, and the way they sort of set up, you know, the conversations with the sort of outside investigators and the helpers, like, obviously they don't need to have these conversations where, like, a defense attorney's like, so when you're in a trial, you know, Ron Kuby does not need to be told this.
Yeah.
But I feel like how they structure the stuff is good, and you don't have to be, like, a super true crime nerd to watch this show and understand what's happening, but at the same time, super true crime nerds won't feel like, you know, they can just sort of glaze off that their intelligence is being insulted.
Yeah, agree. You called for a clip that introduces one of the attorneys on the
yes.
team. Shall I play that? And then you can talk a little bit about why yeah. you wanted us to listen to that.
I'm yeah. Sue Ann. I'm a former state attorney in Florida. I'm a defense attorney now. I've been a lawyer for 10 years. I've worked on wrongful conviction cases before.
She also has flawless eyelashes at all times.
Yeah, I guess she, to me, is sort of like the odd man out in the two episodes we saw. So it's sort of unfair since I haven't seen all six. She's the one where I'm trying to figure out what she's bringing to the table. Because everybody else, so the other people that we see, of course, you know, Kuby, who everybody knows, he's the guy with the ponytail that you see anytime, you know, what is it? He says something like, I've been fighting law enforcement for 30 years or something. So, you know, he's a real true believer. We, you know, we have this former Fed, my boyfriend, Joe. We have Ira, who is another former law enforcement guy who wears amazing hats and we'll get to it in a second, is also like maybe the best interrogator I have ever seen.
And
like,
yeah, we'll get to it definitely because yeah. they let you in sort of on the process and also on the fact mm-hmm. that like the team is not like sort of striding all, you know, in step with each other towards that Apollo spacecraft. Like they don't always agree. Right. On what you should do. There's also a moment where towards the end of the second episode where we sort of heard part of this phone call at the top of the podcast, but Ron Kuby gets quite emotional listening to Junior Salas, who is calling from jail, saying how meaningful it is to him what they're doing and that maybe there's hope for him to come home yeah. to his dad, who is also quite a flavorful interviewee. But I see what you're saying about Sue Ann because the, you know, I think.
And the thing is, for the benefit of the listeners, Sue Ann is beautiful. It's not just her eyelashes. She's beautiful and she's young. And I am extremely hopeful that she's given more to do as the show progresses because I don't want it to be like, oh, well, we had to have a girl or something. Sue Ann, if you like go and you Google her and stuff, her resume is amazing. She's clearly a very accomplished person. And so I'm just hopeful she does something else here because otherwise it's a real waste of a talented and, you know, woman who could bring a lot to the show.
Yeah,
as well
I agree.
As, you know,
because
same
I think
people.
I think she does. I mean, I don't think that it's a like quota issue, but she is a mm-hmm. woman of color whose job may be redundant with both Kuby's and like, I think once they get to a certain point in their feelings about this story, then they're like, this is no longer an investigation story. This is an appellate story. At which time, spoiler, it is punted off site to an appellate attorney
yeah.
who we meet and everything, but it's like, I mean, I think part of Sue Ann's job also is to be the like, so then what? Interesting. Like, body makeum person on camera that usually
yeah.
Bollinger would be. That's like, does seem like this is a little bit below her pay grade, but okay.
I mean, I think that Sue Ann knows what she's doing. And if Sue Ann's hope or her intention is to parlay this into, you know, punditry or something like that. She is certainly well suited for a role like that. I just, and I'm certainly not arguing that in any way that she's like some sort of affirmative action hire or anything like that.
Oh no, I don't think so either.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm not suggesting that because like I said, you know, you look at her resume, she's not, but, I'm just, you know, these guys talk a lot and she doesn't talk as much. And that frequently happens when you're a woman in a room, especially when you're a younger woman in a room. And I can only imagine when you're also a woman of color in the room. And so I'm just hopeful that, you know, in the four episodes that we haven't watched, that sort of gets moved to the sideline and she gets to step into the spotlight a bit more because she certainly deserves to.
Right. Or she, like you said, she's viewing this as her tryout to transition sure. into like a more Aphrodite Jones role yeah. in the legal community, which is lower impact and better money. And look, we all have loans and I get it. Whatever. She'll be great yeah. at that if she decides to do it.
Sure.
I think the show is also good at setting up the problems with the case against Junior Salas without doing a whole lot of underlining. I'm going to play yeah. clip 3, which is a little bit long, but it's almost all there's a bit at the beginning from the investigator on the ground. And then we go into some contemporaneous news footage that's clutching its pearls about Sunnyside, Washington's transition from a, you know, let's face it, all white, small town, like rural community to a like gang riddled whatever. And this kind of thing I feel is always oversubscribed by the 5 and 6 o'clock news typically, but let's have a listen to clip 3 because it's classic 90s like bleed leading.
There's also a lot of gang activity. As a matter of fact, they were the first city, I believe, in the state of Washington to pass an ordinance against gang activity in the city.
By day, Sunnyside is as peaceful as its name. But when the sun goes down...
What's 04 have, Sunnyside?
Youth gangs roam the streets.
Look at that beautiful mess. How much of this is going to go on before it ends?
We have a real big migrant population here, and they're bringing a lot of knowledge and a lot of that activity with them. It's scary. It's real scary.
What do you guys think of gangs?
They're awesome, man.
They're awesome.
What frightens many people in Sunnyside is the age of some of these gang members. 9, 10, 11 years old. And they've brought a crime wave to this small farming town.
I mean, okay.
It's awesome, man.
First of all, hashtag those kids forever. They were hilarious. Second of all, the number of different dog whistles at the Latinx community in this narration. I sort of lost count after the word migrant. Third of all, and you can always see our visual aids on our social media accounts. That's at Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. But this woman who was sort of exclaiming over like, when is it going to end, has the biggest beehive I've seen outside of John Waters film in quite some time. And I feel like that is such a Mad Libs, like small town struck by maybe two crimes is now seized by horror at what it has become narration. It's like when, you know, there was a manslaughter in my hometown, which is 19,000 people. And it was like, well, now we're the manslaughter capital of Union County. Like, oh, y'all, like, that was bad that that happened. But let's not get going on the crime wave here. And, you know, it's also key that they mention the ages of the so-called gangsters, since Salas, and you'll see this in the visual aids, when, like, his mugshots, he just looks... He's 14 and he looks 11. And their willingness to buy into this narrative that a kid of color would just murder this guy is distressing.
Well, and you just sort of want to say, great, people, then pick your own fucking apples. You know, like,
yeah.
Like, because that's the situation.
That's what I had in my notes that I was like, you want the lettuce that bad, go get it. Yeah, totally.
Well, because like, you know, Yakima is where, you know, where apples come from. If you're sort of on in this part of the world, you know, like there are all these orchards and stuff. It's, you know, it is a great sort of rural place. You know, produce comes from there. It's sort of, you know, second only to California's Central Valley in terms of, you know, where things that everybody eats are grown. And, you know, if white people want to get out there and start picking, you know, plants and stuff, sure, I don't think that there's anyone, you know, saying no, you know, like, sorry, we have an affirmative action quota and it can only be Latin people, but white people don't want these jobs. So guess what? Latin people are going to work these jobs. And that's how we end up with sort of the situation here, because this income divide has, you know, continued in, you know, people aren't paying these laborers more, but everything is getting more expensive, especially in places like Washington that are sort of experiencing this, you know, this boom time. And when you have an income divide, you're going to have crime. That's how it is. I mean, this is like 101 first semester of high school sociology class stuff.
Yeah. You also have kids who, and this was sort of downplayed. Like, I liked that the show was not judgmental towards people that they were interviewing and talking to about Junior and about the town at that time, who clearly had been struggling with some substance abuse problems. Like, they interviewed that grocery clerk, that like 7-Eleven clerk. She didn't really get into it, but it was clear that based on the remaining tooth, that she had probably been wrestling with meth. Junior's mom kind of turned him and his siblings over to the dad, who was working 14 hours a day, and I think still does, and goes to the prison on his one day off a week. And you do have like an— let me be clear. This is not a like latchkey kids are, you know, terrorizing art. That's not a thing. It really isn't. But you have these economic, like this is real economic stress. And this is what can happen when a community is not prepared to like address those things head on and realistically.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it, like I said, the dog whistling was a lot in that segment. And then, but again, keep in mind, this kid was like 5 feet tall and, 14 at the time. And they get into a, ballistics recreation, that sort of doesn't exactly disprove that he could have done it, but makes it hard to believe that he could have shot into a car from that angle. Here's clip four.
It's not impossible, but it's an unusual way.
It's not impossible, but it would be fairly high.
Could he have done this?
The answer is yes, but does this reconstruction affirmatively show that he was the one that shot the firearm in this event? No. This is telling us how, not who.
Well, and there's quite a long segment devoted to the fact that the victim's girlfriend got like was insistent on getting the car back before it had been fully processed. So there's like shell casings and other whatnots that they're never going to find now, possibly in the car. But this segment felt like a network note to me a little bit. Did you find that?
Well, so we have that, and then we have sort of the roundtable discussion of it with, you know, the defense attorney, with Kuby, you know, and the two interrogators too. And Kuby said something that I thought was interesting. Like, he said there was like this sort of jokey line, like maybe if this were sort of a gang signature that you fire from— I'm gesturing, but no one can see me— fire from this angle high up, but that's not how people who kill people kill people.
Right.
And obviously, Kuby is always going to be inclined to assuming that whoever he's talking about didn't do it. But I also think that's right. Like, nobody holds a gun over their own head and shoots straight down. That's not like a cool guy gun thing from a Tarantino movie or
anything. Yeah, I was just going to say that. It's not the, like,
sense.
Side grip. Right, totally.
Exactly, exactly, yeah. But, I mean, just, like, everybody think about shooting a gun for a second. You're not going to hold it over your head and tip it down. Like, how do you even know where you're shooting then? It didn't make sense. But I do think that that is one of those things that you don't think about until someone shows you the lasers and everything. So I thought that it could have been a network note, but I also thought that it was, you know, that stuff can sometimes be super wonky or also be presented in sort of like a, because the thing is, you can find an expert to really, unlike The Good Wife, you can find an expert who will lie practically and, you know, support any sort of argument when it comes to ballistics or forensics. So this stuff isn't as sort of ironclad as, you know, as you might think, but I felt like they explained this in a good way that sort of really does suggest the suspect's innocence.
Yeah, I agree. It just felt a little bit written to me.
Yeah.
In a way that much of the rest of the, at least the episodes that we've seen, didn't feel, especially since the next clip, which you asked for, features the investigators not really agreeing on how they should have handled, where were they leaving? Ophelia's?
Yeah,
house?
Yeah. So Ophelia's the victim's girlfriend, and they really wanted to talk to her and get her side of it. And so Joe, who was once handsome, is now a big fat white guy. He's always white. And Ira, the African-American interrogator, both go to her house, and they subsequently disagree on their interrogation approach. And this was so uncomfortable, but so good.
I know, it really was. Here we go.
Hey, you know, the people that you think are going to talk don't talk, and the people you don't think are going to say a damn word are the ones that roll you the damn confession. You know that.
I usually get everybody to talk, though, one way or the other. Well, get them. I'm telling you something. When I walked over to the side, she was getting ready to talk, and when you step back over, she cut her eyes at you, and then she kind of calmed it back down.
Yeah, but because, we don't know what she was going to talk about.
Shut up, Joe.
But see, what I was going to do, though, I was going to use you and say, hey, look here, he doesn't believe it.
You did that.
I believe that, you know, he is guilty.
Yep.
And then we could have fed off of each other and say, hey, look here, you know, this and that.
Yep.
So sometimes, you know, I'm not criticizing you, but sometimes we have to slow it down.
Except I'm totally criticizing you, and I'm still not sure I exactly know what he was planning there, but...
Oh, he was planning, here's this big fat white guy, here's this cop, here, you know, you and I, Ophelia, are people of color, white guy, you know, this white guy thinks something else, and you and I can align against him. I think it was alliance building, and like, you know, middle-aged white guys do, Joe doesn't even see that that's a play, and, you know, he fucked it up.
Yeah, he's like, wait, I'm good cop. Like, no.
Yeah.
Not anymore.
I mean, I think that's what it was. And the thing, you know, as you know, Sarah, like, the thing is, too, so then they're in the car, and Ira can't quite let it go, and he brings it up, like, two more. Like, it felt like a married couple, really. Like, he was like, you know, the thing is, it was like that sort of thing. It was so great, and the thing is, these two guys, Ira and Joe have great chemistry. Like, I would watch just them doing stuff, like, for hours. Like, I don't need a show about anything else. Like, I would just watch them just hanging out and talking and bullshitting, I think. But it made me happy that they were comfortable around each other enough and also comfortable around the camera enough to be, you know, slightly real. I mean, I bet if the camera weren't there, it might have gotten a little hotter.
Yeah,
but
maybe.
Still that,
but I don't, but yeah, I don't think so. Yeah. Like, I think Ira knows how to, he knows how to, like, be in the story, but also, like, give it to the camera at the same time.
Ira's so good.
Because he's the best. And, like, he has all of his little hats, but also braces that manage to be, like, badass instead of kind of Joe Girardi and goofy.
Mm-hmm.
But he... like, he has a thing where he's talking about going back to the lead detective to brace him, and he's like, yeah, I got a strategy for that. And there's a pause, and he's like, it's called blowing sunshine up his ass, basically.
Yeah.
Which I just thought was really cool. But here's a little more of Joe and Ira on the road. Like, eventually they find this detective who is, like, clearly not, like, he's afraid. Like, he knows that this is not going to end well for him. But he's trying to be, like, super helpful. And then he's like, well, but I don't know where the, you know, this informant is. And let me just go and make sure that he's okay with talking to you. And I haven't talked to him in ages. And then clip six happens. And it's amazing.
Oh, yeah. He's got to be sweating a little bit. Oh, yeah.
So he's knocking on the door and he's trying to get him allegedly to come out and talk to us. Now, this is an informant you haven't seen in years, right? This is an informant that you're comfortable enough to go over there without your gun in your pajama bottoms. And then he comes out and says, Bill don't want to talk to us. He, you know, he wants some time to think about it, that kind of thing, right? So I thought that was interesting.
That's beyond interesting.
Yes. Wow. They into something.
Something's going on.
I kind of want they into something to be my ringtone. And I think it's so smart. Like before that, you're sort of seeing Detective Rivard like trooping around in next to the informant's trailer in his pajama pants, which are like sports team pants. I think they're like Seahawks, like lounge pants, which would that tracks. But like before that, he's like, well, I don't let me just, you know, go see. And like it was a bluff and it got called. So he like drove over to the informant's house and they followed him. And they were like, oh, we'll just tail you to go there. Like that, which is so smart because they could tell that he was going to be like, don't talk to this crew because they're going to try to hang you up.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just fun to see. It's like processy in a way that's like good and not, not self-congratulatory. Like they're just like, all right, this is what we're going to do next. And here's how we would do this. And we'll explain it as we're driving in the car. But yeah, I would totally, this is what like, their stakeout podcast would be like, and I'm here for it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we have one last clip on Detective Rivard. Do you have any comments on that before we play it?
Well, so, you know, for people who haven't watched this is the second episode. So when you hear it, you will not have seen this episode yet. We learn a little more about the lead detective on the case. This was his first homicide ever. And, you know, after being extraordinarily helpful and sort of trying to control the narrative with the detectives for a while, he gives everybody, you know, sort of sitting around the table, gives him a call and he freaks out on the phone and sort of says, well, I've been helping you guys and now I'm done. And everyone tells me I shouldn't talk to you anymore. And then after they get off the phone, this is sort of everybody reacting to that call.
My feeling after listening to him, actually, is I feel bad for the guy. He sounds like somebody desperately trying to talk himself into being the person that he sees himself as being.
And guess what? That's exactly what he wants you to think. That's exactly what he wants everybody else to think.
See, to me, this is just such a distillation of Kubi and like who he is. And, you know, and what has driven him and probably, I know I only met Ira through this show, but, you know, I've obviously, you know, known, not personally, but, you know, I've known of Kubi and, you know, been following him for years, but that Kubi is sitting here still wanting to believe the best in this detective who likely did some really bad things that caused this perhaps innocent person to go to jail. The Kubi still wants to believe that. And Ira right away is like, oh my God, you're fucking falling for this too, ponytail. I mean, I just love that whole thing. And that's what made me like think like, okay, I want to watch the rest of this show. If that sort of tension between the two continues, that to me is way more interesting than we're all fighting for somebody's innocence.
Yeah, for sure. And I also like that. I think that part of it is Kubi being like, you know, ... because I can eat this guy for breakfast on appeal. And he can. Like, this guy is just overmatched and was at the time. And I think that the way they skillfully bring up the idea that Rivard was probably more overmatched and incompetent than schemey And then they just sort of, they have this exchange between Ira Todd and Ron Kuby. And then that's kind of that, like, they don't really belabor the point. That's another thing that I like about this show, and that Stars, you know, the last Berlinger joint that I reviewed was on Investigation Discovery, and it was good, but there was definitely a lot more like repetition and underlining, because it's just a different, it's just a different scene, not on a premium channel. And I think Stars documentary, documentaries and documentary series are really pretty good at just like letting the footage that they get speak for itself, and getting people who like know how to do this but aren't too canned. So yeah, I like this show a lot. I'm going to watch the rest of it. It's good, and I recommend it. What about you?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like it, like, you make a great point that so many true crime shows, I feel, I think that's the weakest thing, is that there's a lot of sort of padding and repetition, you know, which you don't need. And I felt like this show really moved. Like, they're like, we need to get to the next thing. You either got this or you don't. Let's go.
Yeah. And they know, like, they know the audience. They know the audience, and they're sort of like, all right, people are not going to, you know, it's on Stars and it's a wrongful conviction show. Like, people that are here are not randomly here watching it in the waiting room at like county emergency. They're watching with intent.
You weren't like just like watching Outlander and then it came on afterwards or something, and you're like, I don't know. You know what? Then again, maybe you are, because it does have that sort of, if the argument is that true crime mainly appeals to women and Outlander mainly appeals to women, maybe you are. Who knows? Maybe this, maybe Stars wants to be the dirty Lifetime.
And on that note, speaking of dirty Lifetimes, it's time for our cold case. I had never heard of either this show or the crime that it is about to investigate in its first half. I can tell you this. I have never seen, or it has been a long time since I have seen, 22 minutes of a TV show in which everyone involved was enjoying the shit out of their jobs. We are contemplating, at Eve's suggestion, the Herb Baumeister case, as investigated in Behind Mansion Walls, Season 2, Episode 11, and that will be in our show notes. You can watch it on YouTube. The episode's name is Devils in Disguise. Here's the case file adapted somewhat from Wikipedia, and then I'm going to let Eve talk about it more, because it's Indiana shit. Herb Baumeister, alleged to have picked up dozens of men from gay bars in Indianapolis, then killed them, committed suicide before he could be brought to trial, and never confessed to anything, including the provenance of the 11 men whose corpses were found buried on his property. Behind Mansion Walls investigates the state's most prolific, alleged serial killer. Our first clip investigates denial, but before we get into that, Eve, you were recently back in Hoosier Land. Is that what inspired this choice from you?
Oh, Sarah, it's even more, it's even thinner than this. What happened is I was lying in the hammock in my parents' backyard in Indiana. I saw your email and you said, oh, it's a cold case. And I thought, well, I don't want to have to think about it too much. So I just Googled Indianapolis serial killer, thought, hey, I don't know who this guy is. This sounds pretty good. You know, emailed, pulled some YouTube things or whatever, emailed you back, and you picked the show. So I knew nothing about it, and I am ashamed, because this is an amazing story, and all of this shit was going on like right when I started going to gay bars in Indianapolis. So I am, you know, when I started, like, you know, I, of course, like, you do the same thing, right? When I start watching the episode, I keep pausing and hitting Wikipedia and everything else and Indianapolis Stars. And I'm like, how the fuck did I not know about any of this? I should have known everything. Was I just not reading the paper when I was 21? Anyway.
Probably. You know who else needed to read the paper? Especially especially headlines about closets. Mrs. Baumeister. Clip 8 has a lot of things going on. Including, this show has both a British presenter, I don't know why, but he's great, and a narrator who, if I'm not mistaken, I need to find my notes on this, but I believe that this guy, hold please, It's Bill Ratner, who is the same guy who narrates Air Disasters and is like a multiple time Moth Story Slam winner. Like he's won it like seven times. So that's happening. All right, here's clip eight. It's a long one, but we needed it. Enjoy.
But like the ivy climbing over the windowsills of their Tudor mansion, tendrils of disquiet crept into their marriage. The first hint that something was awry appeared just months after their wedding, when Herb was committed to a psychiatric hospital.
About 6 months after they had married, his father had him committed. And I remember asking her, you know, how she felt or what she made of that. And she said she just never asked. Kids.
Julie never discovers that Herb was once diagnosed with schizophrenia.
I think that's somewhat telling because over the years there seemed to be a lot of things she didn't question.
Frank conversation isn't the only thing missing from the Baumeister's marriage.
She did tell me that over the course of what I believe was a 25-year marriage, that they actually had sexual intercourse six times. She never saw Herb nude, and she said it was because he was self-conscious, because he was so tall and thin.
I mean,
tall and thin, exactly what I don't want in a man.
I mean, okay, so his father has your husband committed, and you never ask. Okay. Also, apparently Herb's boys could really swim because they had like three kids.
Oh, I know. It's insane, right? Yeah. Or, you know, Mrs. Herb was just remarkably fertile. So I want to start with our British presenter who, of course, I went down a huge hole with him. So Christopher Mason is his website is astounding. But in the show notes, Sarah, I left for you the link to his satirical songs website. So he does parody songs sort of like Tom Lehrer or Weird Al, but they're about like New York society people. So anyway, the link's in there for everyone to enjoy. But this guy is a piece of work. But he wrote this book, The Art of the Steal, which is about like this sort of like scammy art world stuff that I remember reading and enjoying back in like sort of the mid-aughts. But I have no memory of what it was about. Shelf.
That's him?
Right. Yeah. This is the guy.
Oh,
I mean,
my
God. But the whole thing, this guy, I don't know if you'd say he's a polymath, but the satirical songs part was the part that I found most fascinating, and how they dress him on this show. I sent you a screen cap I especially enjoyed via Twitter, Sarah. They dress him like he's some sort of dachshund or something with bow ties and gingham and red strings and stuff. It's super weird. So I don't.
Yeah, it's a lot. That is on. That was sent to our Twitter account at Blotter Presents, and my response was a screen cap of the luxuriously mustachioed private investigator detailed to this case, Virgil Vandegraff. No, Vandegriff, taking a bite out of crime.
This is apparently what Indianapolis private investigators are like. Well, so there are a couple of sort of things. So the structure of this show is horrible crimes that happen from behind walls of fabulous homes. And like so many of these true crime shows, in fact, like I think the last time I was on, we talked about like the Ice-T show. The Ice-T show is not about, you know, like where they sort of try to force crimes into like this structure. This is what the show is about. Here's the problem. They keep talking about like all of these mansions in this Tony part of Indiana, you know, this sort of, it's supposedly like Indianapolis. It's not Indianapolis. It's this other county outside of Indianapolis. We have this one detective saying homes there go for between $30 and $50 million. Well, I did a Zillow search, friends. The most expensive house I could find was $2.5 million. And according to census data, the median income there is about $49K. So this is not as fancy a neighborhood as the show would have you believe. And Herb, you know, they say, oh, he's this heir to this retail fortune. His dad owned two Indianapolis thrift stores. So this wasn't like Joe Macy's or something. There's no Joe Macy's. I made that up. But you know what I mean? Like this, there was, yeah. Like, so this guy had a big, nice house sort of in the middle of nowhere in Indiana, but that's really easy because there's a lot of nowhere to be in the middle of and build a really big house. And the best part of this, and this is also in the show notes, is that this house was later on this, what was it? It was on Paranormal Witness.
Right.
These other people who are just like super regular people bought the house later and claim that that Herb is now haunting it, even though he ended up taking his own life elsewhere.
Well, yeah.
Anyway,
and he's haunting it? There's like five guys that they could never successfully identify who were buried back there. Anyway.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Here's another thing that's interesting about that. It's like, first of all, the reenactor playing this guy, Sean McKean, I think his name is. They have him made up very like oddly. So that he always, and then occasionally they'll like do a slow pan in on his face and then he'll throw in a little twitch. This is a man who's very good at his job and loves it. So kudos, but I totally agree with you about the, they're trying to force like, well, here's a case. And then we have to make it fit into this sort of like arbitrary rubric that we picked out. I feel like I've been noticing that way more in recent episodes of The Blotter, actually, that it's kind of like, you know, rich people are fucked up. We know that. Like, why do we have to be so like rigidly faithful to the idea that this mansion, that the mansion is like the through line of this? Oh, and P.S. local law enforcement throughout the world. If Fox is in the name of a local eccentric rich person's estate, just do some drive-bys every now and then. Just make sure everything's okay, because between this dude and John DuPont, like, you know, figure it out. Fox in the name, bad. Not that they really cared one way or the other, because apparently people had been trying to point out that Baumeister was bad news, and also that gay men were just, you know, vanishing. And apparently it wasn't really so much the climate for a task force in clip 9.
And in 1990s Indiana, it seems being gay is akin to being invisible.
I think if it had been young blonde co-eds disappearing, young blonde college students, that would have been very different. Some of the victims' families tried to contact the police and the media, but they just weren't interested.
Well, yeah. I mean, Pride Month, like, everybody. Like, this was not something that was just a problem in Indiana. Viz American Crime Story that we just saw earlier this year, like, crimes in that community weren't cared about necessarily.
Well, but I do not think that that is untrue. And I do think that when you're the member of any marginalized community, be that gay folks, especially back then, sex workers, people who aren't white,
yeah,
you know, you're going to have more trouble getting your, you know, your murders sort of solved. But I also, okay, so I just turned 47. So I was 21 in 92. And that's when I started going to, because I lived in the Indianapolis area at that point, started going to gay bars. So how it works in Indianapolis, or worked back then, is there was one street that had like three gay bars that everybody went to. And then there were two sort of outlier gay bars that were sort of further away that you would have to drive to get to. One of those was a lesbian bar, which, fun fact, was Adam Egoyan's inspiration for the bar in Exotica.
Huh.
Didn't look like that, though. It did not look like that. It was like a strip mall gay bar, lesbian bar. It was not as pretty. But anyway, he was there for a film festival, and that's what inspired him. And the other one was like this bar called OP's. I don't know if it's still there. I just remember that on the sign, like the logo was a toilet. That's the one where you'd go towards the end of the night. Like,
okay,
it was like the filthiest, grossest one, where like the worst stuff happened. And The other three, like, one of them's still there. That's, like, where Blair St. Clair from the most recent, the current season of Drag Race, like, does her shows. Okay. The other one, NYC, was, like, really amazing. It's closed. And there was a third one that was sort of, like, the old gay dude bar.
Okay.
So there was, like, this very vibrant gay bar scene on this, like, sort of three-block area of the quote-unquote cool part. But it was arguably the cool part of Indianapolis. So it's not like this was sort of this hidden thing where guys were just doing it in bathroom stalls or something. It was out, it was open, there were drag queens walking down the street. Everybody was, you know? But this is what is so interesting that, you know, when we're watching this, it's like, here are the pictures of all the missing guys up on the bulletin boards in the gay bars. A, no bulletin boards. This isn't the front of the co-op. It's a bar, you know? And B, like, so, you know, after I watched this, I started messaging, like, a lot of the guys I was running around with back then. And I'm like, do you remember anybody talking about this stuff back then? And everyone's like, no, absolutely not. Was anyone warning us about it? No. We were all still talking about Dahmer. Because that's, like, the other thing is that Indianapolis is the crux of all of these freeways, right? So Indianapolis is arguably a place where a lot of active serial killers are sort of passing through, because we've got 465, we've got 70, we've got 65. There are all these interstates. That's why Indianapolis is called the Crossroads of America. We've got all of these interstates running through. So if you are an active serial killer or an active serial anything, bank robber, rapist, whatever else, you're inevitably going to commit one of those crimes in the greater Indianapolis area. And I think that that's one of the things that sort of interested me in Bauermeister, because even though it's not addressed on this show, years later, they end up trying to pin this other series of crimes on him. They also said that he was the I-70 strangler. And a lot of journalists who were working in Indianapolis, this is like, they decided in 98 that he also committed these crimes. A lot of journalists who work in Indianapolis, especially like folks who worked at the Big Alt Weekly and folks who worked at the gay paper, are like, they're just trying to pin this shit on him too, because it's an election year.
Right. So, and they want to like close these red balls. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And all these, the I-70 strangler, these were all young men, probably hustlers. I'm sorry to characterize the victims that way, but you know what I mean? These were young guys who had fewer social connections than these guys who turned up missing in Indianapolis. And that's the other thing, is that, you know, the folks who were going to gay bars in, you know, the early 90s in Indiana, once again, these weren't hustlers. These weren't sex workers. These were the regular guys, your dentist, the guy next to you at your cube, the guy waiting on you. And so, you know, just sort of characterizing this as crimes that no one cared about. These weren't randos. These were people with families and relationships and part of a network, which did mean that, you know, that's one of the reasons that some of them were able to be identified later on and others weren't.
Right. Well, and there's this guy who sort of like went back, you know, undercover, like what wasn't mm-hmm. killed, and then sort of like spotted, quote, Brian Smart again and got his license plate number and really helped them to crack the case. Not that Baumeister admitted anything, but unfortunately, once your kid finds a skull on the property,
it's a
very different story. Is Behind Mansion Walls a thorough investigation that gets into, I don't know, anything that Eve just mentioned? No. Is it hilarious? Yes, it is. Clip 10.
The well-heeled residents of Westfield, Indiana, normally expect to find manicured lawns and carefully trimmed hedges in their backyards. Not human skulls.
Not exactly normal.
It's the fall of 1994.
Look at that.
And housewife Julie Baumeister is stunned by her son's discovery.
She was kind of startled, to say the least.
Can I keep it?
No!
Oh my God! The thing is, the visual is, this kid is walking into this kitchen set with a skull, talking to his mom in a pink cardigan, who's wearing a pink cardigan. He's holding this dirty skull he found in the ground. Hey guys, can I have, I mean, Was there anything in anything you read, Sarah, that suggested that this young man had a disability of some sort?
No.
Because...
Yeah. Can I keep it? Amazing.
I'm not going to keep... And he kept asking that, too. It almost felt improvised. Like, it was so hilarious. Hey, and, you know, yeah. Hey,
and there's a scene later... Baumeister's rationale for why there were human bones in the backyard is that someone stole his father's med school skeleton. And the
maybe
way
an animal got it out of the garage.
Yes, like some whatever, some hyena dragged a med school skeleton into the garage. And the way that this is reenacted by Mr. McKean is amazing. It's so like he's so perfectly like, oh, that old thing? It's probably just my dad's med school skeleton that a dog got to. And the wife is like, eh? Oh, God, it's amazing. And then she, like, her alas, poor Julie face when she's like, she doesn't realize that it's a skull until she turns it around. And then she's like, eek! It's so good. Yeah. And it'll be on our Twitter account, so you should follow us. Oh, my God. It's... I mean, the show is like actually fairly bad and not all that informative, but I had a great time. The time just really flew by, and top-notch reenacting, I must say.
But I just don't understand, Sarah, why neither you nor I, given, you know, our combined sort of brain trust here, which is, you know, I think immense, we can agree, that neither of us were really that familiar with the case. Like, I went and like I looked. I was like, has anyone written a book on this? Because if not, Sarah and I will. And there's only one. I've already ordered it from Amazon. I'll let you know how it is.
Oh, is it the one written by the woman we keep hearing in voiceover?
No, it's. I don't think so. I don't think it's anybody. It's just, well, it's Fanny Weinstein. I think I would have remembered if that was her name. The book's called Where the Bodies Are Buried, which is the name of many
her.
Other books.
That's
too.
The woman that we keep hearing.
Her?
Yeah.
Okay, well, anyway, it's out of print, but I ordered the trade paperback from Amazon. I'll in follow-up tweets, I'll let everyone know how it is. But I'm like, there is so much about this case that is so, so, so interesting that the show didn't get into, but that's fine because it's about houses, I guess, kind of.
Well, okay, but keep in mind also, like, shouldn't this case have been on our radar? You'd think so.
Yeah,
and then, like,
right?
You hear that, Stuna Jr. finds a skull in the backyard in the fall of 1994. Like, I think that there were a lot of cases that were current at that time that, like, I was just out of college. I was living with my parents. I was working three jobs. And the only crime that you would think had ever been committed by anyone was the death of Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman. So I kind of understand how that might have slipped by.
Well, but they didn't really start, like, you know, the jig wasn't really up till 96. And that's when they sort of, and I feel like by then, I don't know. So I think Dahmer died in 94 too. So you have that as well. And Dahmer was sort of like the gay killer, I guess, arguably, especially in the Midwest. And like, it seemed like, I don't know, I guess sort of the reason that this is resonating so much with me is that as a young person with many gay friends at that time, every man that I knew had a super fucked up crazy story about some weird thing that could have gone wrong. And the same is true for like every woman that we know, Sarah. You know, if you make it out of your 20s alive, you know, it's a triumph. But especially back then, like, I mean, I just think about all the times where it's like, you know, a guy would like go for a hookup and something would be super weird or whatever. And you look back on all of that and you think, this could have happened to my friends, you know.
Yeah, totally.
My friends could have been one of these, you know, sort of faceless people. And as a, you know, relatively privileged white person, I don't often think that way. And so there's something about that that's just like really ringing with me. And that, you know, I'm sending this Wikipedia link to all my friends who are, you know, also ancient like me now, and that none of us remember it is so weird. Why weren't people warning us in these bars, you know, somebody is hunting you? I don't know. There's something, this, I feel like now if something like that were happening everyone would be telling us. You know, if people were like, hey, Sarah and Eve, you know, angry white women are getting bumped off, you and I would know and we'd stay home.
Yeah. Or, yeah. You know, I was going to say be less angry, but that didn't even merit saying because obviously, no. Yeah.
Not an option.
I sometimes look back at, and like, I was in college, like before roofies were a thing to the extent that like at college orientation now, I think many women are told do not like, mm-hmm. do not have a top off your drink, like have a hand right. over it, have the cap on it. Like don't ever leave it open even for a second. And we didn't get that. And we weren't really given any, you know, briefings about, like, we were told that sexual assault was bad, but like we weren't really told like how to stick together about it or how to talk to each other about it and share information. And certainly, you know, we all got out of our 20s in New York City somehow, but the number of times that friends of mine would just be like not quite falling down, but needing to lean on something. And then they'd go to another gay bar to pick up. And we're all like, all right, bye. Tell us how it goes.
Yep.
Because you just assume you're never going to die when you're 23, which is another thing. But it's also like, I don't know, from the sounds of it, the gay bars that you're talking about, like that's a wider age cross section and more settled people. And it's just interesting how the thinking about how to prevent, like, you know, stranger attacks by a serial killer, I guess, or serial rapists has evolved. And that's a good thing, but it always feels like it's a little bit too late.
Yeah, I agree. That said, you know, if I come into just a little bit of money and can quit everything else I'm doing with the exception of my Westworld recaps and being on this show, I'm writing my Herb Bauermeister book. I'm going back to Indiana every couple of months, talking to people. I'm going to do it because I'm obsessed with this case now, Sarah. So I'm so glad that you asked me to do this podcast, and that I'm so glad I was so lazy that I just Googled Indiana serial killer and came up with this guy.
Yeah, me too. This was a lot of fun to cover. Again, you'll find that link to that in our show notes, and you can all let me know what the second half was like because it also looked hilarious, but I had other things to watch and did not watch it.
I had it on while I was doing laundry. It's some guy from England who met this woman in Sausalito, where I actually was this morning, and then brought her to Perth, or brought her back to England, then killed her, chopped her head off with an axe, and then moved to Perth. Anyway, that's the story.
As you do. Oh, yeah. Boy. All right. Well, on that note, before you plunge into writing your Baumeister book, the definitive Baumeisterpedia, where else can listeners find you?
Well, you can find me on Instagram at EvilB and on Twitter at EveB, which I know is a pain, but that's just how it is, you know. And if you're in San Francisco, I have a store on Irving Street between 42nd and 43rd called Avenues Dry Goods. We specialize in stuff from local artists and craftspeople, and we're always happy to see listeners.
And the Coit Tower t-shirt. I hope it's back in stock soon. I love it.
Oh, yeah.
It's my favorite. Coming up on the Blotter Presents booking sheet, the staircase part, it feels like the millionth, but it's back on Netflix and they've got new episodes. We'll also be covering Smithsonian's miniseries on Prohibition and possibly comparing it to the Ken Burns joint. And from Viola Davis, Last Defense. If you got a tip from the Blotter Presents case files, visit our forums at previously.tv or hit me on social media. That's at Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. My guest has been Eve Beatty. You can find her on Twitter at Eve B. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. Talk to you next time.
Been a production of the Previously.tv podcast network.